You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Teddy Roosevelt once declared that the three greatest American presidents were Washington, Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant. Washington and Lincoln continue to share the top two spots in most presidential rankings, but Grant's reputation has diminished considerably over the years. In his latest book, American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant, Ronald White argues that history has judged Grant unfairly and looks at what made him a brilliant general and a passionate defender of equal rights in post-Civil War America. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ronald White to our show today. Hello.
Good to be with you, Leonard.
You've written three books about Abraham Lincoln. Did that lead to an interest in Ulysses S. Grant?
It did, but once I got into the book on Grant, after about a year, I realized I didn't really know the man. He'd been in the Lincoln book, but I didn't really understand him, and I think most Americans have not either.
In researching this book, did you have access to any documents that hadn't been examined by previous scholars?
I did. Grant papers will finally be completed next year, 2017.
Why so long?
Well, they've been at it since 1962. It's been a mammoth project, and so I was privileged to be able to look at all of those papers.
So let's get to the big question. Why has Grant fallen out of favor among presidential historians?
Well, he fell out fairly early by what we call the lost cause, and this is the effort by first Confederate generals and then newspaper editors to suggest that really the best cause lost, and they only lost because they were overwhelmed by numerical superiority and by the North's industrial might and by that butcher Grant who sacrificed his men needlessly. Well, now we know that's not true, but scholarship often lags behind popular opinion.
And I remember hearing that Grant graduated fairly low in his class, where Robert E. Lee was first or second at West Point. Part of the same sort of story, a way of diminishing Grant?
Yes, I spent a week at West Point trying to understand, as you suggest, he finished 21st out of 39. But later on in his memoirs, he said, I must apologize. And I thought, why did he apologize? I spent my time reading novels. Well, novels were not in at a basically engineering school, but novels might be a key to understanding the intellectual vibrancy of this man.
How did Grant's first name get changed from Hiram?
Well, when he registered for West Point, he registered as Hiram Ulysses Grant, and the registrar said, we don't know anybody by that name. And the congressman who recommended him had thought, well, maybe his middle name is Simpson, his mother's maiden name, so he was registered as Ulysses Simpson Grant. And the registrar said, if you're going to enter this academy, you better have that name.
So he just stuck with it the rest of his life?
He did. Not initially. He still signed his name Hiram at West Point, but then he adopted that name.
Tell us about his childhood. From Ohio, like so many presidents?
Well, he grew up on the frontier of western Ohio. I take some time to tell that story. I think biographers often pass too quickly over the story of the young person. Grant himself said, the reason I don't read biographies is they do not tell enough about the formative period of one's life. I want to know what a boy did as a man. And there's some irony here. For example, boys did what boys do. One of their traits was they all went hunting, and Grant would not fire a rifle to kill an animal. He could not and would not ever do it. The Civil War general as a boy.
His father was a tanner, so
His
father was working with dead animals.
He was working with dead animals, and Grant understood early on he didn't want to be a tanner, all that awful blood and smell.
So with that in mind, it sounds to me the pacifistic tendencies. Why did he decide to attend West Point?
He didn't. His father decided for him. It was a free education, an engineering school. There was no obligation in those days to serve so many years in the military. Many graduated and then went into engineering careers with the newly developing railroads. So Grant went simply because his father said, this will be good for you.
And
once he got there...
And then he started reading novels.
So he started reading novels.
Didn't agree.
Right. Yes. And he enjoyed West Point, and then finally it was really his participation in the war with Mexico that really stuck with him that he wanted to pursue a military career.
Didn't he marry the sister of one of his classmates?
Julia Dent was the sister of his senior classmate, Fred. He met her when he was posted to the Jefferson Barracks at St. Louis, and they had what became just a remarkable friendship, romantic relationship, and marriage.
And it lasted?
It lasted throughout their lives, yes.
You mentioned the Mexican-American War of 1846. It was the first time the U.S. fought on foreign soil. What was his role in that conflict?
Well, his role was they had tapped him to be quartermaster. He wanted to be more in the action, but Zachary Taylor, the commanding general, had observed Grant and his abilities. He made him a quartermaster. Grant resisted, but later on he was grateful because it allowed him to understand how do you supply a very, very large army. That's the key to this army being able to fight to victory.
Didn't he serve in Mexico with many of the men that he would later fight against during the Civil War? Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee.
He did. He admired Robert E. Lee. He fought with all of the men who would serve on the other side. When he came home from the Civil War, the three men who stood up with him at the wedding to Julia would all fight for the Confederacy, including James Longstreet.
But Grant also displayed unusual cultural sensitivity and interest in Mexican history and culture. He seems almost like a modern man.
Well, I wanted to make this point because we all, so many people have travel experiences, but does the experience really take? Many of the soldiers looked down their noses at the poor Mexicans. Grant did not. He learned some Spanish. He wrote to Julia that Monterrey was a more beautiful city than St. Louis, and he really started a love affair with the people and culture of Mexico.
And even learned some Spanish.
He did. He learned some Spanish.
Now, I remember learning in my high school history class that the Mexican-American War was an unjust war. It was really a land grab. What was Grant's thoughts on that?
Well, Grant called it that most wicked war, and he looked back upon it. He said, I probably should have resigned. He said, the very idea of a large country preying upon a small country, it's the most terrible episode in our military history.
I'm speaking with Ronald C. White, who's the author of a number of books on Lincoln, including the New York Times bestseller, A. Lincoln. This one is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. Let's talk about something else that's been hung on Grant, his alcoholism. How serious was it?
Well, this is much debated by those who were his contemporaries. He did do some drinking, I believe. He drank when he was lonely and depressed, when he was posted out to the Pacific Coast. I don't think he was an alcoholic or a drunkard. Maybe he couldn't, as a fairly small man, hold his liquor very well. I think this is something that he mastered as he moved forward into his life.
Do we know whether it interfered with his duties?
It never interfered with his duties. Again, there are some stories that would suggest that, but I don't believe they have any credence.
Why did he resign from the Army?
He was posted to first Oregon and then California. He missed his wife terribly. He had not seen his second child. He was accused of drinking, and he just decided he had to get back and be with his family.
And then he went into business, became a farmer, but failed.
7 years he tried a whole variety of vocations, including farming. Not always his fault, sometimes the circumstances, the market, so to speak, of that day. Finally, at the end of the 7 years, he accepted the position underneath his younger brother in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, where he lived when the war broke out.
And then he decided to rejoin the Army to fight the Civil War. Was he an abolitionist?
The strange thing is, there's so much irony in biography. His father was strongly anti-slavery, but Ulysses says he was not anti-slavery until the experience of the war brought him to this point. The further he traveled to the South, the more he met the freed slaves, he began to change his mind and began to take this view into himself. At first, he carried out the policies of emancipation simply as a military officer obeying civilian rule, but when he became president, this became very much who he was and what he would defend.
Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer with limited military experience, or none. How did he master the nuances of military strategy? Did he recognize in Grant somebody he could lean on?
Well, Lincoln worked hard at being commander-in-chief. He actually checked books out of the Library of Congress on this. as we know, I think in the Lincoln story, he had to deal with a variety of failed generals. But when he found Grant, the Western general, he saw this is a man who, as he said to one of his interviewers, he fights, and he put his backing behind him.
But Lincoln did understand that he had a strength that the South didn't have. The Union's two big advantages were manpower and industrial production.
Yes, and so over time, the North could use that advantage, but the frustration for Lincoln was that that advantage wasn't being used until Grant, and I would also add Sherman.
And why did he have such a frustrating time identifying a general who could accomplish what he wanted?
Well, one of the realities is that the persons who went through West Point really, in those years, were not really prepared to lead large armies. You might be a success in a classroom, but to be able to lead an army of 40, 60, 80, 100, 120,000 men took a very different skill, and Grant had that skill.
And do we know why? It was just innate?
Well, it was innate, but it was also learned. I point out in my biography that he learned from his own mistakes. I mean, I think that's a key thing. Do we learn from our mistakes? He did. He admitted his mistakes, not being aware that the Confederates might counterattack. So he learned from them and became a much better general as the years went by.
Why was he less interested in capturing territory than the other generals?
He understood that the South, of course, was a huge territory. That capturing territory was not the goal, capturing armies. And this was one of the distinctions between he and the generals who had served before him. They could never capture all the territory. They had to finally capture and defeat the armies.
So here is Grant. He's a low man on the totem pole originally. How does he move up the ranks? And did Lincoln have a high opinion of him?
He moved up the ranks by his steady cascade of victories, and Lincoln watched this. Grant had an advocate, Elihu Washburn was the Republican congressman from the district of Galena, Illinois. He had Lincoln's ear, and he kept bringing to Lincoln's attention the victories of Grant.
And did Grant admire Lincoln?
Very much so. In fact, in 1864, when the war was still touch and go, there was threat that others might run against Lincoln. Lincoln was worried that Grant might do so, but Grant let Lincoln know, no, you're the person I'm going to vote for. This is not my goal.
How did the Battle of Shiloh begin in 1862? This is a key moment in Grant's career.
It is. In April 1862, the Northern Army was advancing south. And this is one of those moments where we have to say honestly that Grant was surprised on the first day, that he did not expect the Southern Army, Albert Sidney Johnston's army, to attack. But they did. But by the second day, Grant turned everything around and won a great victory in a very, very bloody battle that signaled to the whole nation the cost of the war.
Because there were heavy losses on both sides.
Heavy losses.
Why were there so many casualties, over 23,000 in 2 days of fighting?
Well, the way they fought, standing up, firing these muskets, but also the still somewhat primitive medical care where so many men died of disease and illness and amputation, wounds from the war.
Although he won the battle, wasn't Grant criticized by members of Congress?
He was criticized.
For what?
How could he have been surprised? Why didn't he anticipate the what was going to take place? Very much criticized.
And he was demoted as a result?
Well, he was put on the shelf. He was made second in command to Henry Halleck, who came out to lead the army at that point. And Grant was at one point ready to resign. And his dear friend, William Tecumseh Sherman, rushed over to him and persuaded him not to do so, that his time would still come.
And he still had Lincoln's support.
He still had Lincoln's support, yes.
Why was the Confederate stronghold of Vicksburg, Mississippi, so strategically important?
Well, this town guarded the Mississippi, and everyone understood that whoever controlled the Mississippi, in a sense, controlled the nation. But Vicksburg, a small town, was a fortress, like a Gibraltar. Very, very difficult, and this became the longest battle. Interestingly, the tactics of Grant, I discovered in my research, would be resurfacing in a 1986 Army manual as a model by the way one should fight a war today.
The Siege of Vicksburg.
The Siege of Vicksburg.
What happened? What was Grant's contribution to the strategy?
Well, the strategy was they tried four times to attack from the north. They were coming from north to south. He then got south of Vicksburg, and instead of making a direct attack on Vicksburg to the northwest, he went to the northeast and fought five separate battles so that his army could never be confronted by the large Confederate army. It took him time, but his strategy so surprised Vicksburg, and it won the day.
So being unorthodox in strategy.
Yes. Yes, he wasn't. He didn't follow just all the theorems that he had learned at West Point.
But Lee had the reputation for being the brilliant tactician.
He did, and he was a very brilliant tactician, but Lee had never faced someone like Grant. Grant was told, "You've never met Bobby Lee." But what happened in armies in those days, Leonard, was that they would fight 2-3 days and then drop back, refit, rest. Grant determined that he would fight on and on day after day because he had the larger force.
How much did they know each other before Lee surrendered his army in April 1865? They both attended West Point, but not at the same time. They had fought together in the Mexican War, but did they have much of a relationship?
They did not. They were really a half a generation apart. Lee graduated 1829. Grant, 1843. They had met once in Mexico at the signing at Appomattox. Grant said to Lee, "I remember you," and Lee sort of said, "Well, I'm sorry, I don't quite remember you." I mean, they were a very different status in the war with Mexico.
Was it Grant's decision to offer generous terms to the Confederate soldiers and officers?
It was. 2 or 3 weeks before, Lincoln had communicated to Grant and say, "Now remember, I hold in my hands the solution, the armistice of this war. I'm the political leader." But it happened all so quickly that when Grant arrived, he took out his yellow writing pad and wrote down these generous terms, which were in the spirit of Lincoln, but he had not given perhaps a lot of forethought to.
Hadn't Grant planned to be at the theater with Lincoln on that fateful night?
He did. He arrived back from Appomattox, was invited, he and Julia, to go to the theater that evening. And one of the great lingering questions is, why did he not go?
We don't know.
Well, we have.
But he said he expressed guilt.
He did. Several options. First of all, Julia Dent Grant may not have wanted to go. She had been really put upon by Mary. Julia thought she was being stalked by a man during that day, and then perhaps the real solution or answer was their children had not seen the parents. She said, "Let's just go and see our children."
What were Grant's military duties during the post-war period, the Reconstruction?
He was general-in-chief. The army was completely set down as a civilian army of only 227,000 men. But suddenly he was tasked with the fact that the rights of African Americans were being violated in the South. What would he and the military do?
What were his thoughts about the impeachment proceedings against Andrew Johnson?
He tried so hard to work with Andrew Johnson. He was deferential to civilian leadership. But ultimately he came to have a falling out with Johnson, and so he understood that Johnson probably should go.
And then he winds up entering the race in 1868.
I use a sports metaphor. Unlike a lot of modern politicians, he didn't go after this. He let it come to him. He let the military honor come to him. He let the position come to him. He was the only nomination of the Republican Party at their convention.
And at age 46, wasn't he the youngest man ever elected to be president at that point?
He was the youngest president at that point, yes.
You uncovered evidence of Grant's support for African Americans. Why isn't that story better known?
That's part of the lost cause. It's part of the, you know, Gone with the Wind movie. We haven't wanted to tell that story. But even when we began to rethink it in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement, somehow Grant has not been a part of that story. I think it's a very big part of who he is.
Wasn't there a book called Grant and Lee that had its title changed in the South?
I think it did, yes. I mean, Lee was the great figure. Grant was diminished. Now military historians would say that Grant is the greater of the two generals.
Was he successful in his attempts to dismantle the Ku Klux Klan?
He was, in one sense. He had all kinds of prosecutions of the Klan. He put the military to the task of dismantling them. The problem he encountered was the local and state courts would not prosecute the men once they were apprehended.
So there was the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, and then he sent troops to South Carolina to run thousands of Klansmen out of the state.
He did.
But obviously the Klan outlasted Grant.
The Klan did outlast Grant, yes.
Was Grant in favor of the third and last of the Reconstruction Amendments, which granted African American men the right to vote?
Well, this was the whole point of the Klan. I use the modern phrase voter suppression. The Klan were really about voter suppression. They knew that the voters, African Americans, would vote Republican. Grant won the presidency. People forget this, too. He won the Electoral College easily, but he won the popular vote only because 400,000 African Americans voted for him.
And then why did the women's suffrage movement oppose the 15th Amendment, which granted rights to African-American men?
Well, it didn't go far enough. The women realized as the war went forward that they should be a part of the suffrage, too.
Now, this is also the time of the Indian Wars.
Yes.
What was Grant's position on that?
Well, Grant startled people when in his inaugural address in 1869, he said, "We need to rethink the Indian question. We have treated the Indians immorally." And against the opposition of his own generals, Sherman and Philip Sheridan, he convened a meeting to begin to rethink how we were to treat the Indians in a more moral way.
The Lakota Sioux had been granted possession of much of Montana, Wyoming, and South Dakota. But why did gold miners and others pressure Grant to break the terms of that treaty?
Well, the gold miners wanted to come into the Black Hills. And at first, Grant said, "I will protect the Indian rights." But finally, he made the decision, rightly or wrongly, to say, I can't put a military in to keep thousands of gold miners coming in. And this is one of the areas where he stepped back from his protection of the Indians.
And he was president during Custer's last stand.
He was. Yes.
Was Custer somebody he was even aware of as a military figure?
Not very aware of, no.
He wasn't corrupt, but why did he tolerate corrupt behavior from members of his administration? Was he too trusting?
Well, this is one of the contradictions or enigmas that his second term, he did serve two terms, was rife with scandals. No one ever implicated him. What was he doing? Was he not paying attention? Was he too trusting? Probably both of those things were true.
And there was also the Panic of 1873. What led to that? A depression?
A depression. It really started as a worldwide depression, and then it affected the United States, and it actually lasted probably all the way to almost 1880. But Grant stepped forward. He had a steep learning curve, but he worked with the Secretary of the Treasury and tried to work to alleviate this.
Did he consider running for a third term?
He did. Even with the scandals, he would have been elected in 1877 if he wanted to be. Julia wanted him to run, but he said, "No, this is enough." There were no term limits.
But then he went on a world tour and was hailed everywhere as a symbol of American democracy.
He was. He went on a tour really as a private citizen and was quite surprised by the way he became this kind of symbol of America.
How did Mark Twain come to publish his memoirs?
Well, when Ulysses came back a few years later, he invested all of his funds into a Wall Street firm of which his son was a partner. It was a Ponzi scheme. And in one day, Grant lost all of his money. He wasn't going to publish his memoirs. He thought they were very self-serving. This is the way you earn scores. We see all the memoirs published in recent presidential administrations. The Century magazine offered him $10,000. Mark Twain heard about this and said, "That's what you'd offer an unknown Comanche to write his memoirs." He said, "I'll tell you what, I'll publish your memoirs and I'll give you 70% of the proceeds."
And the book was praised as a classic of American literature, an immediate bestseller. And I guess the royalties helped to provide for his family after he died. Is it worth reading today?
It is. I've had many, many, many people tell me in the last few months how they've read it with great appreciation.
Now, Groucho Marx used to ask the question of losing contestants,
right,
who's buried in Grant's tomb, and sometimes they didn't know the answer. But is Grant buried in Grant's tomb on Riverside Drive?
Ulysses and Julia are both buried there, yes.
In the 70s, the tomb was marred by neglect and graffiti, but it's been restored. Do you see an analogy with your book and the restoration of Grant's reputation?
I like your suggestion. I'm going to speak to the for the Grant Monument Association. Yes, I think Grant's reputation is being restored, and the monument, through a wonderful group of people, is being restored too.
Ronald C. White, Jr., his book, American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.